Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to Wild Horse and Burro Radio, an educational outreach program of Wild Horse Freedom Federation. Please feel free to call in with any questions you might have for our guests during the second half hour of the show. Before I introduce our guest tonight, I wanted to say that on behalf of the Board of Directors of Wild Horse Freedom Federation, our thoughts and prayers are with the families, friends, and victims of the mass shootings in Las Vegas. I also want to take a moment to remind our listeners that the U.S. Senate will be voting on two issues in the 2018 budget that will greatly impact both wild horses and our domestic equines. One issue is the Department of Interior's language in the 2018 budget that calls for 46,000 wild horses and burros in BLM holding facilities and tens of thousands more on public lands to be euthanized. That just means killed, because they're not going to bring a vet in to kindly euthanize each one, so they could be shot, sold, end up in the slaughter pipeline. And the second issue is that horse slaughter may be approved in the U.S. again with this 2018 budget. So please, please, please call your U.S. senators and ask them not to kill, euthanize, or sterilize our wild horses and burros, and also ask them to oppose horse slaughter in the United States. Lobbyists and powerful interest groups, including the NRA and Safari Club International, an organization we'll be talking about tonight, are pushing for the killing of our wild horses and burros and starting up horse slaughter plants in the U.S. again. So the only chance we have to save our wild horses and burros is for each of you to call your U.S. senators. Our guest tonight is Sam Hohola, a former deputy resident agent in charge for Department of Interior's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Office of Law Enforcement in Los Angeles area from 2006 to 2008. Sam also had over 24 years in federal wildlife law enforcement experience working long-term covert operations. He worked deep covert operations for 6 years in the legacy U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's branch of special operations targeting international wildlife smugglers. From 2003 to 2006, Sam worked in San Francisco with the FBI, IRS, and ICE on a task force investigating money laundering, tax evasion, trademark infringement, and ivory trafficking. In 1994, Sam assisted the Secret Service in a covert capacity to uncover a counterfeiting network in Las Vegas. Welcome to the Wild Horse and Burro Radio, Sam.
Thank you. Thank you, Debbie. I'm delighted to be here and look forward to the next hour.
Yeah, well, Sam, people often confuse the Department of Interior's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service that you worked for with the USDA's Wildlife Services. So can you tell our listeners the difference between these two?
Well, it's U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, under the Department of the Interior, and USDA regulates the wildlife services, which is, in essence, animal damage control across the western United States, primarily on federal public lands like Bureau of Land Management. And wildlife services has been the subject of in-depth inquiries as to the amount of animals that they eliminate, the types of animals that are eliminated, and many times it's very surprising the types of animals that are involved. It's not your typical raccoon or coyote, but it involves a whole host of other species that are involved. And there's a article that I wrote about that, and it's in a World Animal News article. And when I was profiling for a name change for U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, because there's so much confusion between who Fish and Wildlife Service is and what they do, fish and game, and it's been ongoing confusion for decades. People get entities confused from the state to the federal level.
Well, just so people know, you're the good guy, and the USDA's wildlife services are the ones that are setting out the cyanide traps and you know, doing all that. So I wanted to clarify that you're not out, you haven't been out setting cyanide traps.
No, no. In fact, there's a case, if speaking of cyanide traps, it goes back into the 1980s involving a California condor, and in which it was suspected of being killed with a cyanide type trap, and it's it was quite involved back then, and there was an investigation, and many of these cases that happened in the 1980s, people have to remember that the internet was in its infancy then, so a lot of these articles, a lot of these things that were on paper, a lot of times they don't make it to be accessed easily on the internet unless people pull up a newspaper. Section and a particular type of newspaper, for example, the LA Times, and you go back historically to see what transpired back then, and it's usually only in the minds of people that experienced that back then that can recall these things.
Can you tell us about wildlife trafficking? We'll start off with that tonight.
Yes, wildlife trafficking, it's a multi, and it's been quoted by a number of sources, it's a multi-billion dollar industry of illegal wildlife trafficking. It's involved. It's involved. It's very evolved over the years, and it's constantly evolving. It involves a whole host of species that are trafficked for their parts. And people have heard about rhinos, and of course the rhino horn, and elephant ivory. But there's also other species that have ivory. Narwhals, the unicorn type whale that is found in the high Arctic, they have ivory, and there's recent cases where they've targeted people that were trafficking in that type of ivory. People can do research online. They can look it up and look up narwhal, N-A-R-W-H-A-L, ivory trafficking. There's it's one of those species that a lot of people don't recognize or know about, and also wildlife trafficking. It's been estimated at one time $10 billion years ago, back at the turn of the century. Then there were estimates of $20 billion, but it's actually higher now because it also incorporates the protection under the Lacey Act of plants and timber, illegal timber that's being harvested. And there were Lacey Act amendments. Lacey Act was a law that was passed in 1900 for the to address the whole issue of market hunting. And since then, there's felony provisions behind it. It often is used in conjunction with the Endangered Species Act, which is one of those laws that we enforce also, that agents and wildlife enforce. There's a whole host of laws. There's the Airborne Hunting Act, the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and a Bald and Golden Eagle Protection Act.
Can you just tell us a little bit about that Airborne Hunting Act?
Airborne Hunting Act is enacted, and generally the agents that investigate that act the most are agents up in Alaska. And there's basically, in essence, what the law says is that you cannot fly an aircraft and communicate with somebody on the ground when they're, say, for example, an individual hunter on the ground that is seeking a brown bear or a polar bear. And they're on a hunt. You can't use an aircraft to aid in harassing and pushing the animal towards the hunter, or communicating with the hunter on the ground with the pilot from the aircraft to put them in place where they can facilitate the killing of the animal in a much easier and quicker way. And it has to be over a sustained period. Also, when the other part of the law is when people are scouting around for animals, trophy hunters, for example, like say for bighorn sheep, in Nevada, mm-hmm. If it's over a sustained period and they're causing the sheep to be stressed, a group of sheep on a mountainside, and they're pushing them along a mountainside, and they're running with their tongues hanging out, that's a violation of the Airborne Hunting Act because it's harassing the animal. But it has to be proved, to be able to prove that, someone has to be able to witness it and see it over a sustained period. A sustained period could be several minutes. There's no hard and fast time frame for what a sustained period.
Boy, I'm sure thinking about the roundups of the wild horses and burros as you're talking about this. You know, because
right.
they chase them with helicopters and drive them into a trap. And, you know, they put barbed wire on a trap. And, you know, the horses were getting caught in it and injured. So,
mm-hmm.
interesting.
Well, the Airborne Hunting Act, primarily what it applies to is big game animals.
Hunting, yeah.
Yeah, and that's what mm-hmm. it's... And it's a law that most agents across the United States don't get a chance to enforce because
mm-hmm.
it's primarily over the western United States, and it's often very difficult to document. Someone has to be
mm-hmm.
an agent
mm-hmm.
has to be at the right time at the right place when this activity is occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if they're not there in a covert capacity, it's generally they have to get a tip that something like this is happening, but they also have to witness it
mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
and to be able to articulate it in a detailed report or
mm-hmm.
have video footage, that kind of thing.
Yeah. So do you think that there's been less wildlife trafficking or about the same or more than like 10 years
mm-hmm.
ago?
Oh, no. If you look at... And what's exacerbated it, for example, when I was working at the port of entry in Los Angeles, UPS, the UPS hub down in the southeastern part of the United States, I believe they had over 67,000 parcels coming into the United States per day through that hub. And then
oh,
you got
wow.
the FedEx. So you got the FedEx hub and many times, and then you've got the mail facility. There's a mail facility in south of San Francisco. It's actually in a place called Brisbane. But it's South San
mm-hmm.
Francisco, and that's where all the mail comes in through from Asia. And U.S. Customs and Border Protection has they are working the mail facility there. They have dogs there, canine detection dogs, to look for heroin. And very often, sometimes they encounter illegal wildlife that is sent.
Mm-hmm.
I happened to work on a case years ago when I was in San Francisco. And involved the Los Angeles office where there was an individual from Diamond Bar, California, that was facilitating the smuggling of these rare tortoises into the United States, and they came in a parcel. The first group came in a parcel, and they were we did a controlled delivery to this business in Diamond
mm-hmm.
Bar, California. Of these tortoises, and they were marked, and we documented this controlled delivery, and that's just one parcel that was luckily intercepted. And
mm-hmm.
there's ivory that can come in. Sometimes raw ivory will come in, and it is intercepted. If Customs and Border Protection, what they're usually looking for, of course, is heroin and counterfeit goods. Sometimes they'll encounter
mm-hmm.
something that is of questionable. They cannot identify exactly what it is. They know there's something. It might be ivory, and that's when they call wildlife inspectors, U.S. Fish and Wildlife inspectors at the ports, to come and identify these things. And then if it
mm-hmm.
turns into a criminal investigation, the agents get involved, and then they investigate those particular instances. And sometimes they very often work with Immigration and Customs Enforcement, the U.S. Postal Service, Postal Inspection Service, because it involves something coming in the mail that's illegal,
mm-hmm,
and those kinds of things. So it's very prevalent. I mean, it's grown exponentially because of online through when eBay first started out, and you got Craigslist, you got all these online opportunities for people to sell all kinds of commodities on there, and sometimes, very oftentimes, it's ivory that is sold there, illegal animal parts, and eBay has a fraud investigative team that looks into these types of issues. Is it totally controllable? Absolutely not. It's hard to control because these people figure out how to sell the commodities labeled as something else, and maybe they have very faded photographs, and they're very surreptitious in how they sell this stuff.
Mm-hmm. So
it's
interesting.
Not always easy to trace. But to answer your question, it's in the tens of billions of dollars. It's probably by far, right now as we speak, it's probably larger than what we even, our government is able to get, realize how large it is. For example, rhino horn, for example, has grown exponentially in value, and it is highly desirable across the planet from various criminal syndicates, and it requires international cooperation to be able to address these types of issues.
Can we talk a little bit about trophy hunters? Tell us a little bit about trophy hunters.
Yeah, trophy hunting, for example, you know, when I worked for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, Safari Club International, back in about 2000, somewhere around there, 2001, there was probably about 41,000 members of Safari Club International. Now there's somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000. So it's they're a very powerful organization. They have legal people on their staff. They have annual conventions, used to be primarily in Reno, Nevada, but they're also in Las Vegas. They go back and forth between Reno and Las Vegas. There's also other groups that have conventions and meetings every year. There's a group that meets in Harrisburg every year. It's an annual convention there. And there's some Safari Club people that go there, but it's a separate type of thing.
And there's
hunters that hunt, and at these conventions they have guides and outfitters from all over the world that book hunters on hunts. They have brochures. And it's a 4-day convention. It's quite an extravaganza. There's some very influential people that attend these conventions, and it's I've gone to probably 20 conventions in my career, and I've seen it evolve over the years from an organization that had millionaires, right, to what I call the mega wealthy people now. There's people that are billionaires that belong to Safari Club. There's people that are worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Very active.
So they have a lot of political sway. Yeah.
Oh no, they do have a lot of political, and some former presidents have belonged to Safari Club International. It's a very prestigious organization. There's lifetime memberships that they sell. They auction off hunts at these annual meetings that they have at the convention center. There's hunts from around the world that guides and outfitters will auction off hunts. People can bid on them. They auction jewelry off. You know, there's very, very expensive jewelry that's auctioned off there many times. It's quite an event, and then they have mounted animals there on display, so people can look and see the types of animals, and maybe that an outfitter or a guide is known to have taken some successful clients out and hunt and for whatever it is, whether it be leopards, elephants, and this is all permitted. There's permits involved, and sometimes things go awry. When for example, like that particular case about the
Walter Palmer, the dentist, yeah,
right?
Cecil the Lion, and he killed Cecil the Lion.
No, it's that was killed in Zimbabwe, and it was killed in an area on or near Wangi National Park. And I've had the opportunity to work an investigation way before Dr. Palmer's incident involving him and hunting in Zimbabwe and the whole ordeal there. And it involved a company called Out of Africa Adventurous Safaris. And if people look at that, and there's two brothers that ran that organization back then, and they had operations in Zimbabwe. They had a base in Kansas here in the United States. I believe they had some connections in Alabama. But I was unable to bring any charges against that organization, Out of Africa Adventurous Safaris, although I investigated them with other agents for back in 2003, 2004. But what we learned from that investigation is that the laws from Zimbabwe were so poorly written that there was no way that we could attach that those laws to the Lacey Act to bring charges against any people there was a few people that we were looking at, and we were unable to bring in, and simply because the laws were so poorly written by that country's wildlife people years ago, and it kind of carries over to today, the whole thing with Dr. Palmer. So,
what are your thoughts on why people are trophy hunters? What do you think? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know what? I've worked undercover operations. In fact, one of my first investigations that I worked in was in Southern Colorado back in the mid 1980s on a trophy hunting group, hunting in and around the Southern Ute Reservation. And I spent time around trophy hunters. My background, I was interested in it, and I was documenting violations of the Lacey Act involving illegal elk and mule deer at the time. And if you look, it's kind of a common thread. What's kind of really captured the spirit of trophy hunting per se initially is this organization called Boone and Crockett, the Boone and Crockett Club. Mm-hmm. Then you got Pope and Young for archery, and this is a scoring system. This is a Boone and Crockett. What they do is, for example, if somebody kills a large mule deer, they take measurements of the horns and they take subtractions for imperfected, you know, like on one side of the antlers to the other side of the antlers. They take the width of it. There's quite a few measurements that are involved. And if it's a very symmetrical rack to a mule deer, a large trophy mule deer, and it meets all the criteria, and they do measurements after it's dried, and then it gets into Boone and Crockett. It's a very prestigious thing to get it, and they have Boone and Crockett for just about every big game animal there is. They measure. It's all about the measurement of the horns many times, and it's a very competitive thing when people have a lot of money to be able to get into.
So they want, so trophy hunters want, say, the biggest animals or the rarest animals, or
Well, I'll give you an example. For lions, for African lions, back when I was conducting this investigation into this. Trophy hunting organization that was in Africa at the time, out of Africa Adventurous Safaris, and which a colleague of mine years later, recently, was able to bring charges up on this same organization that was doing things with rhino hunts, illegally, and they continued to operate doing these things and expose themselves to a huge investigation where there were formal charges brought recently. In recent times, I say in 2014. Now, what lion hunters like, every real lion hunter type enthusiast, trophy hunter would like to get a black mane lion, one with a black mane. These are highly desirable animals, but at the same time, they're hard to get. It's not easy to get a black mane lion. And some of these black mane lions were in Wangi National Park. And therein lies the problems is when somebody wants an animal like that. And, of course, there's always sometimes, and it's every incident of where there's allegations of illegal hunting, it's very difficult to show who knew what, when, and where. Oftentimes when a hunter pays $60,000 for a big game trophy hunt, they expect their guide to take them on a legal hunt or a legitimate hunt in an area where they can bag a big animal. And many times it's kind of like, hey, I'm paying these guys all this money. I'm paying for this hunt. I shouldn't have to ask any questions. I leave it up all to these people, you know. And therein lies the problem sometimes, because some guides and outfitters, not all, will take shortcuts and say, well, you know, if you want a black mane lion, I can guarantee that you can get one. But it's going to take work, and I'm going to need a little bit more money. And then the hunter says, well, God, I'm here. Let's go do it. And then it becomes a question of, okay, am I in the legal area or am I not in the legal area? And sometimes people like, hey, I just want that big lion. Mm-hmm. Some hunters.
Yeah,
so
they can make excuses later. Yeah.
So, but these cases are hard to prove. They're not that easy to prove.
Well, Safari Club International, have they ever done any illegal activities or pretty much just
All you have to do is research online and go back and to you can look in these historical accounts where people have been investigated over the years, and primarily there was a large number of investigations in the 1980s into various Safari Club members. Not a lot of them, but quite a number of them. These were one of the investigations I know, a colleague of mine in the Carolinas, he was profiled in one of his cases and his investigation into impropriety using museum mounts and taking tax write-offs from some trophies.
Mm-hmm.
Now these are situations that happened in the 80s. They're not that easy to find. You got to know what to look for, what keywords to use.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
these things aren't up front on the internet where you could find these things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's...
go ahead.
So that's I guess what I'm trying to emphasize is some of the largest investigations that we had in trophy hunting were actually in the 1980s, and not as much as we did then. There's some now. There's a few. There's some very significant ones.
Aren't there currently two bills in the House of Representatives that could help, like H.R. 2603 and H.R. 717?
No, those two bills are actually... they were proposed, and they're a detriment. They're an actual detriment to the Endangered Species Act, and people need to really call their congressmen and senators, and tell them that they don't want to see these types of bills passed, because it could actually hamper agents' their ability to enforce regulations on endangered species coming from outside the United States. I haven't looked at these bills that closely. People, you have to do research on it and read about it and read what the issues are and why these bills are. But all the people that are conservationists that I know of are opposed to these two bills, the H.R. 2603 and H.R. 717. You know, they've spent millions of dollars. The United States has spent millions of dollars over the years, going all the way back to the California condor and many species of concern to protect these species, and now they're going to mess around with the Endangered Species Act. I saw there was one senator, I believe, from Utah, and I read where
Chris Stewart?
No, it was Rob Bishop, I believe.
Oh, Rob Bishop. Yeah, we're familiar with him.
And it seemed like, I thought I read that he was wanting to just eliminate the Endangered Species Act. And I thought, well, that must be fake news, because no senator could possibly be that stupid to propose something like that.
He was at the Secretive Slaughter Summit they recently had in Salt Lake City, Utah. It's called the Horse and Burro Rangeland Management Coalition. And they're the ones, I mean, Safari Club International is a member, NRA is a member, various groups. But the public wasn't invited, but it was really the groups pushing horse slaughter. And we had, members of the BLM and Department of Interior show up there, but the general public was not invited. So, he got up and made some stupid joke. I posted an article about it just because, he rode in like on a little toy horse, like that was funny when they're talking about horse slaughter. So he's kind of.
So he really did say he's really trying to eliminate part or all portions of the Endangered Species Act. It sounds like. I mean, I thought it was fake news when I first read it. I thought this must be. It's the real thing, then, huh? It's
the
tragic.
Real thing.
I don't know how these people are voted into office. I mean, their agenda is counterproductive. It's destructive to endangered species, and it's from after all the decades of spending money to protect these things, and now we're trying to do that. And,
Didn't Safari Club International try to have grizzlies delisted as an endangered species?
Well, not grizzlies as a whole, but particularly the grizzlies in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, because grizzlies are still protected in other ecosystems. But the one that everybody's looking at, of course, is the delisting of the grizzly in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, and they would be very excited if there was an opportunity presented itself for hunting licenses or specific permits to be given to hunt a grizzly bear in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem.
Oh, wow.
And I understand that because I've been around hunters all my life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I understand that kind of thinking. It excites people. It's, for example, there was this bear that was killed years ago, a number of years ago, called a polar grizz. And it was a hybrid of a polar bear and a grizzly bear.
Mm-hmm.
During one of the Safari Club International conventions, they had it on display there. If I'm not mistaken, they had it there. It was viewed there. People were very excited about that. It was a very unique hybrid of a species, and people found that very fascinating. Trophy hunters found it of great interest, I'm sure. And the gentleman who killed it, he thought he was killing a, he didn't realize what it was at the time, and it turned out to be a polar grizz, a very unique hybrid. And,
wow.
So you got sheep hunters also, wild sheep hunters that like to hunt wild sheep. You got the Grand Slam. It's called the Grand Slam, where you have all these four of the North American wild sheep that can be hunted as trophies. It's very difficult to hunt these things very often. You have to have the right permits. It takes a great deal of time and effort and money to secure something like that. So it all boils down to, I've got this sheep on the wall, and this is this Boone and Crockett score. It's number 3 in the book. In other words, there's 2 other people that have a higher scoring sheep that was killed. But they can apply that to any species of animal.
Wow.
So it's just people get very angry about trophy hunting and all that. I understand that, but if I got angry about trophy hunters when I was in my career, if I really got worked up about it, I would have never made any of the cases that I made. None of them.
Mm-hmm.
Because people ask, well, how do you do this work? How can you stand these people? I don't even look at it that way. To me, it's like, okay, I'm trying to catch these people doing something that I know that they're doing that's illegal, and I want to be there when that happens. That's all I care about. So I don't get worked up in all the emotions of any of that. Can't do it. Otherwise, and some people can't do that kind of work because of just the nature of the work itself. Sometimes agents would have to kill animals to be able to fit in, to document things. I had to, and I learned all about that kind of behavior, trophy hunting, and it's not an easy thing to do, but to me it's another group that's out there that has impacts, positive or negative, as some people may think it may be, on the ecosystem. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole host of other issues, like wind power, mining.
Yeah. Really quickly, before we get into those topics, could you, in connection with the endangered species, can you tell our listeners a little bit about the listing and delisting procedures?
Yeah, well, for example, the delisting procedure, what they do is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service puts out a federal register of a proposed rule. People have time to review the rule. They review it, and they decide, and there's a comment period afterwards. For example, I'll give you an example. There's this wind power facility up in 2012. It was the Shiloh wind power facility. They were granting a five-year permit for the taking of a golden eagle up there. They were going to allow them to have a take permit. And myself and another former agent voiced our concerns by submitting our concerns in writing to the Federal Register during the comment period, and they post these. They post all these comments. And then they decide, after reading all these comments, At some point, it's decided, okay, we're going to grant the permit or we're not going to grant the permit. And it's mm-hmm. like that with just about everything that is listed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a time frame that goes by. For example, like the grizzly bear in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem, the federal government would like the states to take over at some point, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, to be able to manage grizzly bears, to manage them as they see fit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's about states' rights.
Mm-hmm.
Many
mm-hmm.
times, you know, Nevada, when I worked in Nevada, that was a big thing there, and also in
Idaho.
No,
it's still a big thing.
Yeah,
it's
people,
still a
you
big
know,
thing.
Let's turn it over to the states and let them manage their own. I mean, it sounds like a great idea in many ways. It sounds that way. But unfortunately, as one of my friends that's a research biologist, a very prominent research biologist over many years, I was down with him in Arizona recently, and we were talking about all these things that impact wildlife. And he said, you know what? I've come to the conclusion after all these years that humanity's DNA is flawed. You know,
mm-hmm.
you're going to have so many people out there doing the wrong thing and trying to get, because of personal gain or they want something to benefit from it, but it's not beneficial for a particular species. And it makes sense to me.
Yeah. Didn't the wind power industries, they had 5-year kill permits. Wasn't that extended to 30 years or something?
Well,
can you tell our listeners about that?
Well, yes. There's a 30-year permit process, but they haven't issued any 30-year permits. There's been a few
mm-hmm.
5-year permits, but there's been no 30-year permits that have been issued to
okay.
the best from what I've seen.
Okay.
I know they would like to see that in play. You know,
mm-hmm.
some wind power facilities would love to have
mm-hmm.
a 30-year permit. And the argument from the wind industry is, okay, in order for us to be viable over a period of years, we're going to have this permit process in order for us to be able to continue to build more wind turbines and not be restricted by a 5-year, you know,
mm-hmm.
permit or policy. We need something over that is more of a longer-term commitment.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, there's been two companies that have been prosecuted for killing birds with wind turbines. I know one is Duke Energy, and
uh-huh.
I can't think of the other one, but there's been two that have been substantial fines and penalties
mm-hmm.
as a result of their activities. And it kind of
mm-hmm.
sent a message to the wind industry that that's what we're going to do. But they
yeah.
They granted a 30-year permit in December of 2016. That's what they were pushing for. But
mm-hmm.
it's very specific. It doesn't mean that everybody that applies for that permit, every wind power facility, they're not going to get it.
And what company got the 30-year permit?
No, there hasn't been any. None.
Oh, there hasn't
Zero.
Been any. Okay.
None.
All right.
None.
All right.
None of them. There's been some 5-year permits. There's one that I know of.
Uh-huh.
There may be several others.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure which ones, but I know there's one in Northern California. And
mm-hmm.
it's not that easy for them to get these kinds of permits. There's a very strict criteria they have.
Mm-hmm.
The problem that I have is the reporting, because when they report something that is killed or killed around a particular wind facility, an eagle could get hit by wind prop by one of these wind turbines, but it could fly for a while before it dies.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Fly off
a few miles away, and they'll never find it. Yeah.
Yeah, or it's eaten up by a coyote or something. It's wounded,
mm-hmm.
But these things, when they estimate the deaths, who knows how many deaths there are? But it's oftentimes
yeah.
to me it seems like it's a self-reporting system.
Uh-huh.
You know, there's no third party that I've seen, and maybe they're working on it. I don't know. A third party.
Have you seen any approximate estimates or how many birds are killed
per year by
wind turbines?
There's a variety of estimates. I know there's one gentleman that puts a lot of time and effort into research. His name is Jim
mm-hmm.
Wigan. Jim Wigan.
Mm-hmm.
He's a biologist,
mm-hmm.
and he has charts. He has statistics. And he's very, very knowledgeable in that arena, and I've seen estimates of 140,000 up to 328,000. But they also kill bats.
Year.
Yeah, per year.
Yeah.
But they also
yeah.
kill bats, too. That's the other thing. Their document is killing bats. So
but basically, the fines, are the fines minimal then?
Well, not for those two particular corporations.
Companies.
That were fined.
Uh-huh.
They were fined a substantial amount of money. And there's all you'd have to do is just Google wind power companies fined for migratory bird deaths. And then you
mm-hmm.
can find the companies that were. In fact, I knew the federal prosecutor for at least one of them. I knew him, and he a wonderful man, Bob Anderson. He passed away about a year ago. And it was very dynamic. But these kind of cases are not easy to make. It takes a great deal. They're tenacious. They involve a lot of subpoenas, a lot of interviews.
Is it the case then that many wind power companies haven't ever been prosecuted?
Well,
because of that.
That's true. But for example, I give you an example. Altamont, when I was working in Northern California, they'd been killing eagles since the mid 1980s. And never once were they prosecuted. Were they investigated? Yes, but there was never any prosecution.
Wow.
And that's what's disturbing is they got off on the wrong foot by and they say, well, wait a minute, because I was investigating the mining industry over in Nevada at the same time. I had a colleague from Sacramento from the Fish and Wildlife Service call me and say, how are you getting these huge fines in these mines over there? On these gold and silver mining operations. And they weren't only happening in Nevada. I worked with other agents that were was an agent up in Idaho. He worked on a mining case up there and got a big fine there. Another agent in South Dakota, they went after some mines there and they got some fines and penalties.
Mm-hmm.
And the fines and penalties were high enough that it motivated the mining industry to cover these cyanide pits in many cases, or neutralize the cyanide.
Oh, that's when birds were getting poisoned up there, right? Like,
right.
You were telling me about Alligator Ridge near Ely, Nevada, something like that.
Yeah, they're getting poisoned by cyanide, which is a byproduct of the processing that they use to extract microscopic gold. Very fascinating field of. In fact, Nevada back in the 80s was the fourth largest producer of gold in the world. Most people don't realize that. I mean, that's huge. It was like a tremendous amount. And most of the gold that was being taken out of Nevada, majority of it, went to foreign countries that own these mining corporations. Canada, other.
I think that's still going on. I think that's still going on, Sam.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. I'm sure that there's. I mean, the thing is, then you have the cone of depression that's created by what they call dewatering, extracting groundwater, and pulling water from these aquifers. Big debate about that. There was a gentleman named, he's a professor, Dr. Glenn Miller from Reno, UNR, back in the 1980s, and he was studied the groundwater. The dewatering of, and he was with the Sierra Club there, and did extensive investigations into this whole thing.
Well, it's my opinion that the reason they're extending or expanding so many mines, because as soon as those pits fill up with, if they stop the mining and it fills up, then they're going to have a big environmental catastrophe, especially because there are so many mines in such a close proximity. In areas of Nevada. So I think that's why they keep expanding. They'll have EAs for expansions of these mines. And I'm thinking, gee, they've already used so much water and torn up so much area. Why do they have to expand it? And it's just they're putting off to tomorrow, so it's on somebody else's watch, that this becomes an environmental catastrophe.
Well,
if
you have Barrick Gold Strike, one of these large mines and stuff, they say of these mines, these huge mining corporations, that if they close down, they're still going to have that water coming out. I mean, it could be a big, who knows what's going to happen then, when that happens.
I still had one question I wanted to ask you about the wind power companies. Are they receiving subsidies?
Yes, they're receiving subsidies, have been receiving subsidies for quite some time. I wrote an article for World Animal News titled, it was about examining President Obama's presidential wildlife, you know, the wildlife legacy of President Obama. And in there I mentioned the subsidies, and I wanted to be balanced, so I mentioned these excessive subsidies, not only for wind power, but for fossil fuel and the insurance industry. I mean, there's so many subsidies across our country, and it all boils down to lobbyists. You know, that's what's corrupted everything, is these lobbyists going to Congress, and they ask for these subsidies. As a matter of fact, Warren Buffett was quoted at some point that, well, if we weren't given tax credits, it wouldn't be beneficial to build all these wind power facilities.
Well, and the interesting thing, I think I read somewhere that the wind power companies have already received about $176 billion in subsidies. Billion
right.
With a B. Yeah.
Right. The amount that I quoted was a very – it just depends on how it's
figured out. Yeah.
Figured out and presented. But that doesn't surprise me at all, because they were given – billions of dollars. I mean, if you just Google, if listeners would just Google taxpayer subsidies, wind power industry, excessive taxpayer subsidies, wind power, and you pull up a whole host of articles, and it just covers how many billions of dollars that have been given to this industry. And it's like, I understand green energy is important, but you know, the wind doesn't always blow. You know, and then of course, my argument is, okay, you want to build them over here, but try putting them off the coast of Malibu and see if they'll be built.
Mm-hmm.
Or off Kenny Bunkport, Maine. See if, in fact, somebody back there is fighting the placement of offshore wind power turbines because they're politically connected back there, and they've been able to stop that. So, you know, but in these smaller communities, as you read about things, you know, the wind power industry in Iowa, it's expanding, Oklahoma. But even some of these communities and some of these leaders are complaining, well, how much benefit are we really getting from that?
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
you know, I guess they have to have a measurable amount of benefit over a period of years. And I guess the wind industry would argue, well, you know, we just started this up. The benefits will be coming.
Mm-hmm,
so,
mm-hmm.
Great deal to debate about that.
Yeah. I know we're getting down to the last about 13 minutes of the show, so I wanted to remind our listeners, if anyone would like to call in and ask them a question, just dial 917-388-4520 and press 1 if you want to ask them a question. Sam, one thing I really wanted to touch on tonight, too, there was a lot of indiscriminate killing of eagles and grizzlies and wolves. And I think in Idaho there were toxic meatballs and stuff like that. Could you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Well, there was a case. A colleague of mine did an extraordinary case of a particular individual that was going out in the wilds of Idaho and placing meatballs that were laced with a toxic substance. And, of course, these wolves were coming in contact with this, and they were able to. It was one of the most incredible investigations I've ever seen any agent work. They did a great deal of forensics. They did a great deal of field observations, and they were able to put this case together. But back in the 80s, there was actually reports that we used to get. I worked in Reno, Nevada, then up in Idaho. There were because the Reno office. The agent, the resident agent, the supervisor was based in Reno, but he supervised all of Idaho. So on occasion, I would go up and work in Idaho. I'd work undercover operations up there, but I also knew the agents who worked on horseback patrol. And there were four agents back in the 1980s, assigned there to do patrol work in the high country, like along the Centennial Mountains and eastern Idaho, and also in Montana. There was an agent up there working in the high country, and what the reason they were out there on horseback is trying to develop a relationship with some of these sheep herders to figure out, you know, and get information as to who was poisoning some of these grizzly bears. And it was happening, but there again, you know, did they catch everybody doing it? No. Were they able to find every bear that was poisoned? No. I mean, this is because it's a wild area. It's an open area. There were investigations, and some of the substance that was used back then to poison bears was a substance called Temic. It's also known by the name of, I believe it's Aldecarb, but it's Temic. It's a toxic substance, and it's used in the potato industry to kill nematodes in the soil. But once it's taken out, you know, when it's used for other than its intended purpose, it becomes a felony. And therein lies the problem. There, that's why these investigations transpire. We had a case up there where there was a report of a carcass that was found laced with some type of substance. It turned out to be Temic. And it was a sheep carcass. Sometimes they would lace these sheep carcasses up there and try and get rid of a grizzly bear that's coming around or wolves or anything like that. But a bald eagle came in and ate it. We had photos of it.
Oh,
and
wow.
It died of poisonings because bald eagles eat carrion. They eat dead things. Well, this bald eagle came in and ate it and died. So we went up there to investigate, and we could never prove who did it. We had our suspicions, but, you know, people don't talk up there a lot, and we spent a great deal of time up there undercover trying to figure out who the people were and if it was still going on. So that's a problem.
At one time, weren't there – well, isn't there a lab in Oregon that where they do forensics on animals that have been poisoned?
Yes,
did I read that somewhere?
No, it's a colleague of mine, dear colleague of mine, Ken Goddard. He's actually a published author. He's written many books. Fictional books, but his name is Ken Goddard. He's the director up there, Dr. Ken Goddard, and then there's he's the director, and of course there's Dr. Ed Espinosa. He's the number two guy up there. Wonderful people. They run the National Fish and Wildlife Forensics Lab, and they can do just about. And they're the Scotland Yard of wildlife forensics. They look at material that is sent to them from all over the world, from various things. And they work with fish and game agencies, state fish and game agencies many times, and they'll send samples. They'll send, for example, if they find there's a rifle and then they find a bullet, and then they want to do some analysis to determine if that bullet came from that rifle that was seized, then they can do that. They do that type of forensics, and they've had a great deal of success. They do studies with ivory. They have a huge collection of wildlife products up there that they use for educational purposes. Forensics lab is state of the art. I mean, it's the only one of its kind, and in our country, and it's highly regarded, highly touted. I mean, they're they're accredited to the very top level of expertise. I mean, when they give an opinion about something, that's it.
It's solid,
It's solid. It's solid. These are scientists. They got a lot of scientists up there, you know, people that will walk into a room and make the lights go flicker because they got so much brain power.
Wasn't at one time there a mass killing of eagles in Wyoming?
Yes, there was. Many, many years ago. And I see there's another case where something happened egregious. It was like hundreds that were killed. And it turned out there was a book written about it. There was an agent back then, I believe his name was Jim Steinbaugh. He was involved in this investigation many years ago. This was way back in the 70s, late 70s, sometime like that, early 80s. And there was hundreds that were killed. It's just an amazing account. It's one of the most egregious situations where there were so many eagles that were killed, and it was truly tragic. I believe that I can't remember exactly how they were killed, and they had something to do with some ranchers that were out there. I know that. there was something involved with that. So and it was there was a book written about the whole thing, but it was I remember seeing it on the news many years ago.
They yeah, I'll cameras. See if I can find that book. That would be interesting.
Yeah.
And I don't know if this probably isn't related, but I think I also read one of your articles or somewhere that eagles are or were shot to sell feathers on the black market.
Oh no, there's a lot. I've worked a number of undercover operations in my career. That where there are people that are trafficking in eagle parts. There's an investigation that just unfolded recently where they charged a bunch of people in the Dakotas. It was a long-term undercover investigation. The agents did a great job. It's very hard to infiltrate a group of people that do that kind of thing. We were trying to infiltrate a group of people that were shooting eagles off of power lines in western Nevada. And it was we never caught them. We had heard that they were out there doing it. We went out there numerous times, but people are very careful when they do that kind of thing.
Oh, I know. There's especially in Nevada, there's been horses shot. You know, wild horses get shot. So yeah,
and nobody knows
anything about it.
Right.
yeah.
Quote unquote. But the whole thing with the eagle parts, they're used a lot of times in these powwow dances. And there's oftentimes a market where people buy these things. At some of these events, not, and that's just a few people that are doing it. There's a few people that are doing this kind of thing, but it's quite prevalent. And you know, some people they live in these reservations, they're impoverished, and they can make some people can make some money real quick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, shooting an eagle off a power line, and it's not always natives doing it; it's other people too.
Would you say, yeah, go ahead.
But it's very difficult to detect, but there's cases that have been made over the years. You'll see them. I mean, I worked a case with the undercover unit back in 1987, and the title of the case was New Mexico, Arizona Eagle Sales, and we worked in Gallup, New Mexico, and there was I was buying feather fans there from some of the businesses, from the people that were dealing them, and quite prevalent, and so we cleaned that whole area up, but we spent weeks there, and it was buying feather fans, eagle feather fans. Sometimes they'd even have feather fans made out of scissor tail flycatchers that come from Oklahoma. They're only and anhingas. You've heard of anhingas, right?
No.
They're the water birds that are found in Florida. And their feathers are used used in the black market, or sold in the black market. So it's across the United States. Years ago, there was a guy that killed 100 eagles up in Canada and brought them down to the Four Corners area to sell in the black market.
Wow.
Okay. You're coming. I'm having a hard time hearing what you're saying.
Okay, we're down to our last 2 minutes. Can you hear me
okay.
now?
Yeah, I hear you.
And I want to have you back on this show again sometime, Sam, because I still had a lot of questions that I wanted to ask you. And I was telling Marty, I said, Sam's so fascinating. I could talk to him for hours. So hopefully you'll come back on the show again, and I'll get to ask all the questions. I still didn't get to ask you this time, but
I hope everything came up. I'm trying to be objective with things and not, you know, not get. I could never get emotionally attached to certain things that people did, because when I worked undercover for 23 years, I had to blend in with these people.
Well,
so,
and you have to be able to do that to do the work. You know, nobody's going to witness that if they, you know, it takes, like you said, somebody has to be able to do that in order to do the work. That's very important. So I get that. So we're down to like our last minute, Sam. Thanks so much for taking the time to be on the show tonight. And everyone, you can read Sam's articles on PPJ Gazette. If you actually on the promo, I linked to the page with his articles if you want to read some of his articles. I'd like to thank Debbie Dahmer. Well, Marty Oakley started producing the show, and then Debbie Dahmer had to take over. But so thanks to Marty and Deb to helping out with the show tonight. And there's two other shows on TS Radio.
Voices Carry for Animals on Tuesday nights, hosted by Debbie Dahmer, and Whistleblowers on Thursday nights, hosted by Marty Oakley. And I want to thank all of you for listening, and please be sure to call your U.S. senators and ask them not to kill our wild horses and burros, and tell them to oppose horse slaughter in the United States. If we don't make these calls, our wild horses and burros are going to be killed. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you on Wild Horse Wednesday next week. Bye-bye. Thanks, Sam. Good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.